it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Today, it's wine critic Robert Parker. He wields rare power in the world of wine. Many winemakers actually build their wines to cater to his palate. Well, we ask what's informed that palate and what has shaped Robert Parker's taste. To me, most kitchen gadgets are a waste of money, but Christopher Kimball, he of PBS's America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated magazine, has his top five gadgets of the year, and Chris thinks I'll love them. Cookie season is here. Food scientist Shirley Currier has the success secrets that nobody ever tells us. They're from her new book, Bakewise. We talk proper taking of teas with our favorite tea expert, Bill Waddington, like, is milk and sugar a sacrilege? And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by the Devon Cream Company, introducing their new creme fraiche in time for the holidays. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, I understand you've been in one of my favorite towns. You've been in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
We have been in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And in fact, I went to school in Ann Arbor, Michigan many, many years ago, but we were there recently. And the culinary landscape has changed dramatically. The only restaurant I remember from all that time ago is the Pretzel Bell, which is where you used to go and drink beer. I don't know what you ate. But in any case, one of the things we discovered on this trip to Ann Arbor is great breakfast. And the place that we went to that it's one of these places that you would drive by and never look twice at it, but somebody had recommended it to us. It's called the Northside Grill. And when you look at it, it's just like a regular old cafe. You walk in, it's like pretty normal. However, here's how we knew there was something a little bit different about it. We ordered our coffee, and she said, "Would you like French roast?" And I said, "Yeah." And then she said, "Good, it's fair trade organic." Not typical waitress repartee.
No.
But aside from the coffee, I mean, the coffee's fine. But what was really good there were the pancakes. The special of the day was apple oat bran pancakes. And these were so, they had kind of a tweedy oatmeal texture. Mm. And they had like big chunks of caramelized apple in them.
And you do have to pay a little surcharge. For me, it's worth $1.45 to get real maple syrup with it, because in the Midwest, it tends to be Mrs. Butterworth territory.
Well, you do. It's just nice to have a choice.
It is. Yeah. And you do have a choice there. And just to make the meal well-balanced, on the side of our apple oat bran pancakes, we had potato pancakes.
Usual well-balanced Stern meal.
But I have to say this, because these were some mighty fine potato pancakes. I mean, they had a kind of Eastern European flavor about them. I don't even know what that means, but they were very crisp and crunchy on the outside. I mean, they crackled when you bit into them. Creamy inside, and they were served with kind of sprinkled with herbs and spices and topped with slivers of grilled red onion.
Michael, as good as the Northside Grill is in Ann Arbor, it truly is just act one to the main meal, which is Zingerman's Deli, also in Ann Arbor.
The problem with Zingerman's Deli, and I know you know this, Lynn, is that there are so many good things to talk about there that there's never enough time. I mean, what we discovered on this most recent visit is breakfast. I mean, you can have, they have a, in adjoining the old original deli building is a place, I forget, like Zingerman's 2 or whatever the heck they call it, where you can go in there and have really good coffee and an assortment of pastries that live up to the reputation of Zingerman's great breads. I had, what was it I had? It was like a...
cherry bread that had me on my knees.
That was pretty good. Now, I had like a sticky bun that would... that in the place of where you might find raisins, there were like Michigan cherries.
Zingerman's does deliver.
You know, and
there's nothing like it anywhere, really.
I mean, being basically, a New York, a Manhattanite, I won't even say New Yorker, I grew up with Zabar's. And, you know, like every New Yorker think that, you know, whatever we have in New York is the best, you know, and nothing else.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, when I went to Zingerman's, I was ready to burn my birth certificate and put in that I'm from Michigan.
Okay, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, this morning I woke up thinking red lentils. Yeah, I know, I got to get a life. But it was snowing and it was cold and I wanted hot soup for lunch and I had no time to fool around. Hence, red lentils. You see, they cook faster than any other legume, like in 10 or 15 minutes. I chopped up lots of fresh coriander, lots of onion and garlic, and the zest of an orange in the food processor, threw them in a pot with olive oil, and turned the heat to high. Now, when it sizzled and smelled good, I added allspice and cumin and salt and pepper and the red lentils and some water. And when it was all cooked, I finished it off with the juice of that orange. And the best part was the soup was done in 40 minutes. Now, when I heat it up tonight, I'm going to cook in some canned tomatoes and beans, and that'll morph it into something altogether different. Obviously, this was pure improv, but I'm going to put the soup that inspired it, coriander orange-scented red lentil soup, up on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, including our brand new holiday podcast, and information on our book, the one that inspired my lunch. It's called How to Eat Supper: Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. You're going to find them all at splendidtable.org. I think of Cook's Illustrated magazine and its TV brother America's Test Kitchen as the consumer reports of the kitchen. They take no advertising and they take no prisoners. They relentlessly test food and equipment. And since the creator of both is editor-in-chief Christopher Kimball, opinions are not held back either. Well, Christopher is here in the studio and you've brought goodies. Welcome, sir.
Well, great to be back.
All right. So we're looking at gadgets here for gifts?
Yeah, we have five gadgets that are great gifts for Christmas. Some of them are, well, a little more marginal than others in terms of things you absolutely have to have in your right. Christmas stocking. But some of these are things that are phenomenal. I mean, you absolutely need to have them. Now, the first one, this is only $6.49. So
okay.
From a frugality point of view, right. Especially in this economy, it's good. Progressive collapsible funnel. For $6.49 from Progressive. It collapses down to 2 inches high, and then, boom, it opens right up like that.
It looks obscene, Chris. It really does.
Obscenity's fine in the kitchen.
But so you're saying it collapses down.
It collapses down, so it's easy to store. Now, storing funnels is not...
You're right.
It is an issue. Maybe a minor issue, but it's an issue.
Yeah, but you got a good point.
It also has a nice thin spat at the end.
And $6.49, this I could do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, the AccuSharp knife sharp. Now, most people have dull knives.
Right.
And you can go out and buy what we recommend, which is the Chef's Choice knife sharpener, model 130. Costs about $130.
Yes.
Maybe that's why it's model 130.
Yeah.
This little $12 item, AccuSharp knife sharpener, is plastic. And you put the knife down on the counter with the blade up, the sharp edge up, and you put this on top of it and just move it down along the blade. The thing about this that is so remarkable is a sharpening steel doesn't really sharpen a knife. It doesn't take enough of the metal off to really grind it.
Mm-hmm.
This takes a lot of the metal off. It really grinds. And so this does remarkably good job, much better than a sharpening steel.
But isn't that dangerous? Because if you don't have it at the right angle, if you don't have the knife, it's set to the knife blade at the right angle, or if you take off too much metal, you can ruin a very good knife.
The angle's set.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, so that does the job for you.
Yeah, there's no problem.
Okay.
I mean, if you have the money, Chef's Choice is the best. But this does actually a very good job. So On to the most controversial of my five things. This is where I totally disagree with my test kitchen. It happens about once every 5 years. This is about timers. And this is made by American Innovative. It came out a couple years ago. It's a $20 timer. It stands up. It's about 5 or 6 inches high.
You know, it almost looks like an iPod.
It does.
Yeah, it looks like an iPod.
It's gorgeously designed. It is totally non-intuitive. I mean, I think you actually have to go to a school to learn how to use it. So that's why it got marked down in our testing. But once you learn, you know, it took me a couple of weeks, I finally figured out how to do it. You know, this has four different things. And
all of them are about timing. I mean, it doesn't wash dishes or
– doesn't start your car on a cold morning.
Yeah, right, exactly. Here.
So – and it's easy to read, and you can stand it up. Yeah, it's lovely. And
so
it's,
so
it's,
you set it – you set it with – oh,
the,
dear.
Well, there are two rings. This is why it's difficult. There's an outer ring for setting the amount of time, and the inner ring sets which thing – there you go. You're clicking now.
Yeah, and so that's the outer ring.
That sets the time.
Right.
And the inner ring sets which of the four things
you're going to be doing.
See, you didn't even have to go to school.
Oh, wait a minute. It has a box with a dot,
yeah.
So you can tell
which of the
upper left, up, lower right, et cetera. Okay. It is a beautiful thing, and it does feel good in the
hand. $20.
Yeah.
Here's the most expensive thing I have, which is deadly serious, which is the ThermoWorks ThermoPen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you don't own one because you don't need one because you're such a good cook. It's $89. It's a digital thermometer. And what it does is wonderful. The very end of it is where it measures temperature. Now, a lot of the analog instruments, you know, it's about an inch up the probe.
Right.
They don't actually take the temperature to the end. So you actually can get to the center of a roast and you know you're actually measuring the exact center.
What does this have over the $10 instant reading thermometer?
It's much more accurate.
15.
It's got a huge display. Uh-huh. And the little analog ones, they're only good to about 20 degrees. They're hard to read as well.
Right.
And I have to say, unless you're a very experienced cook, it's the best way to find out when things are done. It's terrific.
It's a lot of money. But
there is a cheaper
interesting.
One. It's called CDN.
Uh-huh.
It's about $23, but it has a smaller display. So either of those
okay.
are great.
All right.
Now...
yeah,
the one we've been waiting for.
Yeah,
this is she's never going to have you back on the show.
This looks like
after
a can
I demonstrate
of, this looks like a very expensive hairspray.
It does, or a really strange peppermill.
Yes, exactly.
Well, this is an electric. Hold on, folks, an electric wine opener.
You're kidding.
Now, look, I saw this on Amazon. See, I know
I'm
she.
Sorry.
That's
I'm
it.
Sorry.
And I bought it for $20, and it actually works. I'm going to demonstrate it now. So what you do is take
he brought wine.
It's about an 8-inch
high. I'm getting better about this.
Tube.
Right.
You put it on top of the wine, and you go like this. Now it's going down into the cork, and you just keep it going.
Are you pressing it at all?
I'm just pressing one button. And now the best part is you can actually release the cork when you press the button the other way. Look at that.
All right. Now, how much is this?
I may have you here. $20.
Well, for $20,
it's the stupidest idea.
All right.
Come on.
Maybe. Okay. But
it's made by Oster, by the way. Oster. It's made by Oster. It's $20.
Well, Chris, thank you.
We've done it. We've done it again.
We did it again. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christopher Kimball is our Stump the Cook stump master, but he does have day jobs. He's editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. You can check out Chris's gadget finds, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the power of a palate, talking with Robert Parker, and what nobody ever tells us about cookies. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. This is a statement from a wine website. I quote, "One bad word from Robert Parker can make a winemaker reach for the razor blades." An exaggeration? Well, maybe, but just barely.
Wine critic Robert Parker took his shorthand tasting notes and a simple number rating system and turned himself into the most powerful wine soothsayer in the business. It's been said that Parker's palate, his love of what he calls fruit-forward wines, has changed winemaking on the planet. Certain vineyards make wines to match that Parker palate, hoping for his top 90-plus scores. Robert Parker's latest tome is Parker's Wine Buyer's Guide, number 7. Robert Parker, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
So tell me, how did the Wine Advocate newsletter actually begin?
Well, I started to really love wine when I came back from visiting a girlfriend in France in 1967. And like a lot of, people of my generation, the post-war baby boom, we had a chance to travel and experience European culture and European food. And I obviously got interested in wine. And when I came back to the United States, I started a wine tasting group in 1968 of all years. And so I just started tasting wine, and I got more and more fascinated by it. And, you know, as luck would have, I ended up going to law school and not liking it very much. But I was wondering how could I ever make a living writing about wine, which was my real passion. And so I had just sort of the idea germinated, but it was just a question of being able to leave law and dedicate myself to writing. And I ended up launching the Wine Advocate in 1978. And it was a really risky venture at the time. And, you know, wine writing back in the late 60s and certainly the 70s and the early 80s was dominated by the British and most of the wine writers. And then they were great writers and were wonderful writers, but they had a very romantic view of wine and a very historical view of wine. And there was no hard consumer information available. And certainly in our tasting group, we found that a lot of famous names just didn't live up to their billing. And at the same time, we've discovered wines that were wonderful wines that we couldn't find really any information about. So, I'm a product of the Ralph Nader generation. And so the whole idea of consumer advocacy and trying to, you know, author a publication that had no advertising and avoided conflict of interest, I wanted more independent information. So I ended up just doing it myself.
I've heard a tale. You fell in love with wine as you were pursuing your wife.
Well, I came from a farming family and I was very provincial. In fact, and she came from a much more sophisticated family. In fact, I was so deeply in love with her in 1967. She had taken a junior year abroad. And I had this idea that the French were great lovers, and my girlfriend was really I could lose her to all these very sophisticated French guys, and so I ended up dropping out of the University of Maryland and going over to see her, and ended up spending 6 weeks in Europe. And I remember she was the one who got me interested in tasting wine, saying, "Look, you're here. Why don't you enjoy, you know, the French cuisine and French wine?" And of course, we had no money; we're both students, but we drank wine daily. It was carafe wine. And I always loved to eat, so the idea of discovering escargots and mussels and things like that was fascinating. And the story's got a great ending because I ended up marrying her, and we're still married after 39 years.
that's quite a testimony to French wine and French food.
Well, it sure is, and I think it is a great testimony to the quality of French wines and their enduring nature.
Your taste in wine has become famous and in some quarters infamous, but who were the people who most influenced that taste?
You know, I think that I didn't have any mentor, self-trained as a wine critic. Obviously, I read everything that the great classic writers of my early formation wrote. I mean, the Hugh Johnsons, the Michael Broadbents, the Alexis Lachines, the Harry Walls. I mean, these were people who had written books about wine, relatively romantic books, but also very, very good books. And so it was a matter of self-training. It was a matter of discipline. But certainly, you know, I've always been a Francophile. I think everything I learned in the first 10, 15 years came from visits in France. I have to give France extraordinary credit for you know, my knowledge about wine and by what I think is a classic knowledge of wine. And, of course, then it was branching out into Italy and to Spain, et cetera. And the New World really came much later as far as the formative years.
You know, in this book, you go into some detail about winemaking and how it's evolved over the past 30 years. And there were two things that stood out for me. And the first one was a Dr. Peynot Am I remembering?
Yes, Dr. Emil Peineau. He's passed away, but Peineau was what really he had his day. He was a brilliant professor of oenology at the University of Bordeaux. He was the you've probably heard the phrase Parkerization, which is attributed to people think that wines are made to please me. Well, before that, there was Peineauization, which I think was a myth as well. But the he was the leading consultant oenologist of his day, and he started to have some influence in the 1960s. And really, his influence was for the producers to take more risk when they were harvesting their grapes, that they needed to also keep their yields down. They needed to pick riper fruit. They needed to invest in more sanitary conditions in their cellars so that the wines didn't have off aromas and flavors. And he was a modernist. He was a progressive, and he believed they needed to do this. And he wasn't trying to have French wines compete with the wines of South America or Napa Valley. He was just trying to improve the general level of French wines, working primarily out of Bordeaux. And what happened, just as he was starting to have some influence, we had the international oil crisis of the early 70s, 1972, 1973. Mm-hmm. And the entire wine world sort of just crashed. And so it took really about a decade for French wines to become more popular, to the producers to start to earn money again. And then he started to have much more influence, and they could invest in their cellars and their winemaking equipment. They could do the things in the vineyard that were required. And so he had a profound, profound influence.
You mentioned a phrase, and I saw it repeated again and again in the book and then in other work of yours, fully ripened fruit, which I interpret as the sugars have fully developed in the grape. And that changed the taste of French wine?
Well, I think what happens when you have fully ripe fruit, it's really pretty common sense. Fully ripened means that the skins which contain the acids and the tannins, which can be bitter and astringent and can produce vegetal character, when that grape is perfectly ripe, not underripe, not overripe where it becomes raisiny or pruny, then you have this beautiful sweetness, this noble sweetness of the tannins, which are velvety, and the wine gives you the impression of being expansive and full-flavored but not heavy. And I think that's what he was trying to achieve. And you have to remember that in his era, it's changed a bit, but in his era, most of the grape growers were farmers. And the idea was that why take any risk and keep waiting for the grapes to get fully ripe, because that's when the fall season starts, that's when the rains move in, and we can't risk dilution in the vineyards. But he felt that, it's the old statement, no guts, no glory. You have to take the risk to produce the world's greatest wines.
Interesting. It sounds like it shaped a lot of your taste as well.
It certainly did.
What do you wish for the American wine drinker?
I think it's, first of all, I think it's all about education. I mean, from the very beginning, it's trying to say, look, all I'm really offering is one person's opinion. Now, I have a team that works with me, and is that we offer an opinion that is a guidepost. It's no different than when you're researching a trip to go to Italy or France or Spain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are the local restaurants that are of value? What are the sites that you must see? And what has been fascinating and what has sustained this energy and passion I've had for 30 years is the fact that you're always discovering. You're always a student. You're always relearning. Mm-hmm. And I think is what I want Americans to learn is, first of all, there's no magic moment to drink a wine. Everyone's saying, when should I drink this or whatever? There is no magic moment. It's when you want to drink it. And if it tastes good to you when it's 6 months old versus 15 years old, that's
right.
You.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to get people to try new things and not get fixed on one kind of wine. It's like if the whole world were just eating either chocolate or vanilla ice cream, what a shame that would be. So it's keep an open mind, try different kinds of wines, find out what you really like, and then if you want to take it further, find out why you like these things so much more than other wines.
Well, now I am going to ask you, though, to narrow down, because what I would like you to do is, can you give us an idea of the wine, if you could only pick one or two, greatest value for the money?
I think they're probably today. I mean, I think we're going through an economic, worldwide economic crisis, and wine prices are going to have to go through a correction as well. But I think the great values that exist today are Malbecs that come from Argentina, the Grenache-based Côtes du Rhône that come from southern France,
mm-hmm.
and I think the wines made from grapes such as Primitivo and Aglianico from southern Italy are terrific values. And I think they're, because those areas are very sunny and the climate is more stable than some of the more northerly viticultural areas, the consistency between vintages is very strong.
Bob, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for taking the time. It was a lot of fun.
Wine critic Robert Parker is creator of the Wine Advocate newsletter and author of Parker's Wine Buyer's Guide, number 7. If you're ever going to take a shot at baking cookies, this is your moment. It's cookie exchange season, entertaining season, homemade gift season. And yeah, I know what's in the frozen food case, those cut-and-bake things. And I know they're tempting. But scratch is cheaper, and it's a lot more fun. Well, it's more fun, that is, if you have a food scientist who is a born troubleshooter on your side. I'm talking about Shirley Currier. She always shares tips that nobody ever tells us. Well, Shirley's latest book is Bakewise: The Hows and Whys of Successful Baking. Shirley, it's good to have you back.
My pleasure, Lynn. It's always a thrill to be here.
Shirley, I want to talk cookie control today.
One of the problems, I know I have grandmothers who say, I make wonderful cookies, but when I send them to my grandchildren, they're just a box of crumbs. What can I do to keep my cookies from being so crumbly? Now, this is a matter of gluten. When the cook adds water to flour and stirs, two little proteins, gluten and gliadin, they grab water and each other, and they make these springy, elastic sheets of gluten. And this holds all baked goods together, this gluten. But with cookies, what happens, there's so much fat in there that the fat greases those little proteins, and they can't grab water, and they can't grab each other. So they can't form gluten to hold the cookie together. So the secret is really simple. Take a cup of the flour that you're going to use to make the cookies, sprinkle a tablespoon of water over it, and toss it around. And you have made a little gluten before you added it to the fat.
So,
and you can make cookies any strength that you want. You, by adding more water and stirring a little, you can get a cookie so strong you can use it as a lethal disc, like in 007. That's not the cookie we want, but anyhow, you can do that. You can get any strength you want in the cookie just by how much water you stir into the flour before you stir the rest of the ingredients together. And then we've got the type of cookie, flat and crisp, soft and puffy, or how much spread, or how do you control spread? I know with chocolate chip cookies, the problem I have frequently, someone says, mine are so flat. I make them exactly by the famous Toll House cookie recipe. Mm-hmm. But is there something we can do? Yes. Your batter is wetter than it should be. Now, you're following the recipe. Well, why is it wetter? Because of the flour. See, Ruth Wakefield, when she did the original chocolate chip cookies, she was in New England, and she was using a high-protein all-purpose flour. So today you want to use an unbleached all-purpose or even a bread flour if you're having real spread problems. Because, see, the more proteins in that flour, the more water they absorb, and the firmer the dough's going to be. And also a big secret that we didn't know about. In Ruth Wakefield's Toll House cookbook, she says, we always make the cookies a day ahead, the batter. So they let the cookie batter stand overnight in the refrigerator. This allows the flour to totally soak in moisture, and it also allows some of the big starches in the flour to break down into sugars. And this means that your cookie will brown better. So doing the batter a day ahead with some cookies is a major, major help. And for busy moms, that's a great idea. Do it ahead, and then all you have to do is shape them and cook them.
Shirley, thank you for cookie control. This is great. Thanks.
You're so welcome.
Food scientist Shirley Currier is author of Bakewise: The Hows and Whys of Successful Baking. Now, you can apply all this new knowledge to Shirley's recipe for chocolate crinkle cookies. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. expert Bill Waddington is one of those born teachers. He can take the most esoteric tea and make it intelligible to a novice. Bill goes to the primary sources. He buys his teas from the tea growers around the globe for his tea source shops in Minnesota. And Bill not only learns about the teas, but about their customs as well. Hey, Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
Bill is a tea merchant. What are some of the main questions that you get?
One of the most common questions I get is people come up and say, is it okay to put milk and sugar in my tea? Kind of embarrassed by the idea of adding it. And for me, tea is the national beverage of almost every country in the world, and every country does it differently. So how you like your tea and what your traditions are perfectly okay. So it's interesting to me how all the different countries and cultures of the world have adapted tea to their own tastes.
Some instances, for instance.
Everyone knows about milk and sugar into Britain tea, Great Britain teas, and Americans have added lemon. An interesting country is Germany, northern Germany. They'll add a little brown sugar and occasionally a little dollop of rum in their teas, in the strong Assam teas to northern Germany. Russia, they'll make their teas in a samovar and use a concentrate, and they'll often put in a dollop of grape preserves into their tea, or instead put a sugar cube in their mouth and sip their tea right through the sugar cube.
I've seen that, and where the tea is served in a glass and you hold it between your thumb and middle finger. Your middle finger may be on the rim and your thumb is underneath,
exactly.
And you drink it in that manner.
Yep, exactly.
Taking the tea through the sugar.
Another one of my favorites is in Japan. And you may have run across this tea before. It's a tea from Japan called Genmaicha.
Let me see.
And you probably have tasted it if you can't recognize it by the aroma.
Yeah.
And in this case, they've added something else to the tea. Traditionally,
I'm pouring it out on a piece of paper.
Toasted brown rice.
Oh, yes.
And some of the toasted brown rice kernels pop, so it almost looks like popcorn in there. Some people will call it. So you can add all sorts of things to your tea and still be very traditional and purist about it.
Tea customs in places like China.
China. It's across the board. I've been in China where they throw in all sorts of different blossoms, rose, petals, lotus, chrysanthemum. There are parts of southeastern China where they'll put garlic and onion in their tea.
Really?
Parts of Tibet where they'll add yak butter and a little bit of salt, just a little bit of salt with the yak butter.
Uh-huh.
I've not had that one yet. And they'll even pickle their tea in parts of Southeast Asia sometimes, too.
What do you mean pickle it?
They'll steam or roast the leaves gently, put it in closed bamboo containers for a matter of weeks with some salt, and over that time it literally starts to ferment, and they'll eat the leaves and drink the juice. They pickle the tea.
So they're drinking the pickle juice, essentially.
They are.
But
they
how
are.
Interesting. What a fascinating way to look at a plant that you think of as a beverage source. It becomes a food.
Absolutely.
Huh. Is tea seen in cultures as food? I mean, wine in some cultures, traditionally, is viewed as a food, not an adjunct.
In certain cultures, it is. And in small regions, it is. It is in Tibet. They'll actually brew up barley with the tea itself and make almost a porridge out of it.
Right.
I've seen fish wrapped with tea leaves, large tea leaves, just as you would grape leaves.
Yeah.
So very much so.
Is there, I'm thinking, of course, the Japanese tea ceremony is very famous.
Mm-hmm.
Are there similar ceremonies with that kind of depth of many meanings?
Absolutely. In China, there's a variety of versions of what is referred to as the Gung Fu tea ceremony. Korea has their own tea ceremony. Tea is that social lubricant that allows people to communicate and get to know each other a little bit better, and that's one reason I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And every country does it a little bit differently.
Hey, Bill, thank you. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Bill Waddington is the creator of the Tea Source Shops. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, where did that old expression of status, being the upper crust, come from? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. This is The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. www.thebookshop.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where did that old expression of status, being the upper crust, come from? Well, it came from the 1500s in England. Back then, breads baked in fiercely hot ovens ended up with a bottom crust that was so hard that there was actually an occupation in noble households: the bread chipper. This servant's job was to chip away the bottom crust. And we think this is the age of specialization. Now, this comes from an Australian food historian, Janet Clark, who calls herself the old foodie. And she loves digging into old texts and customs. She says the upper crust was seen as the best part of the bread. And a carving manual from 1513 instructs the bread cutter, a higher status position, by the way, than the bread chipper. Anyway, the manual says that the bread cutter should do this, and this is a quote: "Pare ye loaf round about, then cut the overcrust to your sovereign." In other words, the upper crust only went to the upper crust.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
We are getting ready to take your calls, brought to you by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's see now who is calling. We have got John calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, John, what do you want to talk about?
Celery root.
Celery root. Yeah. Where did you develop an attraction for celery root? This is the kind of thing normally you have to convince people to try.
Sure. About 6 years ago, I was in college and spent a semester in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And living with a couple of retired people, and they used it everywhere in their cooking. And it was just amazing in soups, stews, salads,
yeah,
roasts.
Well, okay, here's the thing. You peel it, and as you know, it's a bit on the knobby side.
Mm-hmm.
Peel it. Generally, it can turn dark. Sometimes you'll find it'll start to darken. Just sprinkle it with some lemon juice or some vinegar, and that'll stop that. Now, if you want to do it raw, what you can do is just thin slice it into sticks. So that would mean thin slice it first into rounds, stack them up, and then just cut through them, making sticks. And then take some red onion and thin slice that as well. And toss that all with some fresh lemon juice or vinegar, whatever vinegar you like. It could be cider vinegar or whatever. Let it sit for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then what you do is toss it with a bit of olive oil, a bit of mayonnaise, and Dijon mustard. And it's a fabulous, fabulous salad. Or you could do a sweet sour version of it, where you toss it with vinegar and a little bit of sugar, and then the other ingredients. And you could have garlic in there or anything else you would like. Now, if you want to do it as mashing it, you could boil up some potatoes and boil up the celery root, too. I'd cut it into small chunks because it takes longer to cook, generally, than potatoes. Drain them when they're tender. Peel the potatoes and take the chunks of celery root and mash them all together with butter and cream. And you will be a very, very happy person. And a little nutmeg and salt and pepper. So that would work as well. And then the other thing, of course, is, as you said, roasting them. And that's a matter of thin slicing. And I'd add, again, some onion and maybe some fresh thyme to that. Toss them in olive oil and put them in a 450-degree oven for about a half hour, 45 minutes.
Sounds great, Lynn.
Yeah, I think you're off and running. By the way, they're great mixed with carrots. They're wonderful mixed with parsnips. So you can mix them up with other vegetables, too, and just steam or boil them and serve them with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. And a bit of lemon, and it's just that simple would be delicious.
Thank you, Lynn.
You're turning me on to celery root again. Thank you. Hey, take care, John.
You too.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have Leonard calling from Monument, Colorado. Hey, Leonard, what do you want to talk about?
Carrot tops.
Excuse me?
Carrot tops.
Oh,
those green,
okay.
Bushy things that come out of the top of the carrots.
Yeah, the ones that grow out of the ground. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the question is, are they good for anything? And this comes up because standing in the checkout line in the grocery store a few weeks ago, my wife was ripping the tops off the fresh carrots to trash them there.
Right.
And a fella came by and said, oh, I make salads out of those.
Huh.
And I was a little leery because I've never seen a recipe with anything about carrot tops. And I went to all the cookbooks that we have, which is a plentiful number,
right,
and found no reference to carrot tops. So I don't know if this guy knew what he was talking about or if these are toxic or can you do anything good with them?
Well, I have to tell you, honestly, I tried them once and I found a little goes a very, very, very long way. Because those babies are strong, and I tried them two ways. I tried them chopped up instead of parsley.
Okay.
In a chicken salad, I think, or something like that. You know, it had meat in it or had some kind of poultry in it. And then I tried them in soup. And I decided I liked carrots better than the carrot tops. But I did discover, and I can't remember the details, because I dug in and did some research about them, because it seemed so logical. I mean, you'd use the top of a beet, you use the top of a turnip.
Exactly.
You know, why wouldn't you use the top of a carrot? And what I did find out is that there is a substance in them that can be very strong, and some people have an allergic reaction to it. I just found I didn't like the taste a lot. But I figure since, you know, if I'm eating it all by myself and I'm not allergic, that's okay. But if I'm serving it to other people, why take a chance?
Right. Well, I could see them sort of in the parsley roll because they even look like it. So.
Yeah, and they're a member of the same family, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, and so is celery. And there's varying degrees of whatever this substance is in parsley and in celery, but evidently carrot tops have more of it, and some people don't like it. Their bodies don't like it, let's put it that way.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Enjoy the program.
You.
Keep it up.
Thank you. Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Now, we've got an email here from Leah in St. Paul. And this is what she says. The featured ingredient in this month's meeting of my food club is sage. And I am to bring a sage-based dessert, but have yet to find one that is sufficiently inspiring. Any suggestions would be much appreciated. Well, Leah, let me tell you. Sage loves pears, almost any kind of dried fruit, especially things like apricots, dried peaches. Anything in the citrus family, but especially lemon and orange, this is one thing to consider, okay? Take pears, all right? Cut them in wedges, peel them and core them so you get maybe 4 pieces per pear. Toss that in a little bit of olive oil with some brown sugar and cinnamon. Spread them out in a roasting pan and roast them at about 400 degrees until they're caramelized on the outside and just barely tender on the inside. Okay? Now, you do this with something like a Bosque pear, those brown pears, because they tend to hold up in this kind of cooking. What you're doing while those pears are roasting is you have some olive oil in a very shallow pan, like a skillet. You put a little bit, like 1/4 inch of olive oil, and you have fresh sage leaves that you've dried completely, so there's no water on them. You drop them in there, and you let them sizzle until they're fried, 30 seconds at most. Scoop them out, drain them on paper towel, and then roll them in a little sugar. Now, when you go to your gathering, you arrange all of those lovely glazed pears that you've roasted on a platter, like a pinwheel maybe, and you sprinkle them with those fried sage leaves that have a little sugar on them. And then what you do is dollop some mascarpone cheese or some sour cream here and there. Fabulous. Another thing you can do is a baked lemon custard, and you can steep, you can actually, as you're baking the custard, you have a few leaves of sage in the custard. So there's some ideas. Call us, 800-537-5252. You know how collecting food-related stuff has become sort of a thing? 40s tablecloths, retro kitchen gadgets, diner menus. Well, writer Hilary Carlip is into yet another kind of culinary collectible, and it has legs, as in stories to tell. Her book is A La Carte, The Secret Lives of Grocery Shoppers. Hilary, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So why don't you explain what you collect?
I collect found shopping lists, people's shopping lists that they've left behind in the cart at the market, at the checkout counter.
What's the draw here?
Well, to me, I think you can tell so much about a person by their shopping list, by the items listed, the handwriting, the kind of paper it's written on, even misspellings. Those are always my favorites. And I think shopping lists are the new memoir.
I love that idea. In this book, you have photographs of these people, and then you tell stories about them.
Well, the people that are photographed are actually all me. I'm 26 different men, women, children. When I always found these lists, mm-hmm. I always imagined who it was who left it behind. And in A La Carte, I just took it a step further and became those people.
I'm looking at the picture of Woody.
Woody is great. Yeah, Woody, that's a really great shopping list because it's simply on a matchbook cover on the inside. And there's two items, Coors and Oreos.
And the picture is he's in front of a liquor store looking down at the camera. He's got a beard, long hair. He's smoking a cigarette. He's wearing a Western belt and a plaid shirt. And to think this is you is almost impossible. I would look at this picture and know immediately this guy is maybe in his late 30s, early 40s. Maybe he has been collecting unemployment for quite a while.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of Woody's. So tell me about Woody.
Well, Woody is, most of the pieces are written as like a glimpse into their lives, and I actually wrote Woody's a little differently as an online dating profile. So Woody is a ladies' man and uh-huh. looking to meet one special lady with no kids and no bankruptcies. And I love that this is on the matchbook, but some of the others, like we're on stationery, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites is on a Prozac notepad. That's Dr. Bloom.
Yeah, she's one of my favorites. Let's talk about Dr. Bloom. Yeah, she's at the deli meat counter, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
and she's got her glasses down on her nose, and she's scrutinizing the ingredients. And she's written her list on a Prozac pad.
It's just simply a pound of Black Forest ham, a half pound roast beef, and a pound of smoked turkey. She's having Gloria Steinem for dinner and the head of the feminist majority and the president of Girls, Inc. You know, she's very feminist, supporting girls all her life, yet her daughters won't even speak to her. So,
another one that I really found interesting was Anoush. Can you tell us about Anoush?
Yes, that list is hysterical. There's some Armenian items on it. But it was clearly written by someone else, and it's a very demanding list. It says a fairly good size of veal shanks, if, and the if is all capital letters and penned in even more intensely than the mm-hmm. rest, if tender, lamb shanks, if not veal, gata, if soft, not hard, bulk bargain sour cherries, if small and ripe and firm. And it goes on, there's like about five more ifs. So to me, that was Anoush's mother-in-law who has moved in with them and is, you know, writing this list, telling her exactly how to shop.
And Anoush tells us about the mother-in-law.
She does.
And she is not particularly a happy camper at this point.
No.
Are you still collecting lists?
Absolutely. And now it's great because the more the book gets out there, people send me lists. And so I have thousands and thousands.
Hilary, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hilary Carlip is author of A La Carte, The Secret Lives of Grocery Shoppers. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this definition of a grocery list. Grocery list, a noun, a piece of paper you spent a half hour writing and then forgot to take with you to the store. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you will find information on our must-have book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Check it all out, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by the Devon Cream Company, makers of Creme Fraiche and Double Devon Cream. Both can be used to make toppings on your holiday desserts and canapes. Available at fine specialty stores nationwide or online at igourmet.com. And by gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation on cooking at gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness, and our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.